This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and we call our show Main Street because these microphones create a virtual Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. The real ones are out there that we love to cross and say hello to each other and, you know, talk about what's on our minds, maybe something we've seen on television or in the movie theater that intrigued us. And today, we're going to explore one man's creative vision with Ashley Thornburg in studio with me here in Fargo, and Samuel Sprinsonatic, a Bismarck-based filmmaker, joins us by our microphone in our Bismarck studio. Thank you for being with us, Samuel.
Thank you for having me.
You are an independent filmmaker. How did you get your start in filmmaking?
Sure. Well, it was about 10, 12, 13 years ago. As a skateboarder, teenage skateboarder, me and my friends wanted to find some way to document the tricks we were doing and, you know, make our own skate videos like the professional ones. And so my grandparents got me and my brother a camera, and that's where it kind of all started.
So you were using equipment that was readily available then, because that long ago we had access to video. It was easy to use, and you've obviously been working on your skills.
Yeah, it was definitely a different piece of equipment than I'd be using nowadays, but it's where I got started, and it's led me to where I am, yeah.
What kind of equipment are you using these days?
These days I'm using a 5D Mark III Canon camera.
That's a serious camera.
Yeah, it is.
It's a pretty nice camera. It's a, you know, it gets you there.
And you prefer documentaries, correct?
I do. I do prefer documentaries.
Well, how would you describe your style or your approach to your subjects?
I would say mine's kind of a natural approach. I don't use a lot of lighting. I don't do a lot of planning. I kind of let the moments find me. I let them present themselves rather than trying to mold and shape and form my subjects or my stories into what I want them to be. So it's a little more natural, I think, than what I've done in the past or what other people are used to doing.
Is that difficult, though? I mean, sometimes a documentary subject can be pretty aware that someone has a camera trained on them, and that can get real awkward.
It can be, but I don't use those moments when they happen. I shoot enough to where I have other moments, and I like to shoot enough and be around the people enough to where they get comfortable with me, to where those natural moments come a little easier and a little better to them.
Well, when Ashley was telling me about you, she mentioned that you've done some very intriguing pieces, like Being Roosevelt, about President Roosevelt reenactors. We see plenty of those in North Dakota.
Yes.
And this Uncle Albert story, this Bismarck man who refused to sell his house to land developers, mm-hmm. and his home is now in the parking lot of a hospital. Intriguing subjects.
Yeah, they're fun ones. I definitely like to pursue subjects and stories that have an interest to me, and that I think are something different than most people are used to hearing. And I think it makes it a little more interesting for everybody that way.
Well, I want to know about the process in particular of the film Uncle Albert, because you're 30 seconds into that film before you are in love with this man.
Yes. Well, the process of – you're talking about the process of kind of how I got started with him?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it was – yeah, last year, beginning of last year, that one of my good friends came to me and said that her uncle, who is Uncle Albert Landsberger, that he was sick and he probably wasn't going to make it too much longer. And so they wanted me to capture his stories, his music, all the things that the family had grown to love of Albert, all the things that you know they want to remember him by. They asked me to capture those, and so I said I would, you know, I'll meet him and see what kind of a man he is and decide from there if it's a story worth pursuing, and met him. And, yeah, he was just, from the moment I met him, he was happy. He was incredible. His energy was just, I wanted more of it.
Well, you can watch excerpts of most of your films on your website, Samuel Spry, S-P-R-Y, .com. This film, Uncle Albert, did go on to win a number of awards on the festival circuit. So I want to talk about how important is the festival circuit to an independent filmmaker?
Sure. Well, to somebody like me, I find it quite important. I don't do a lot of social media, and I don't do a lot of, I would say, self-promoting. And so the only way that I can kind of promote my work and get it out there is by entering into these festivals. And if it's a good enough film, you know, you have to pay – a fee so that people are forced to watch it. And so if it's good enough, I mean, it'll get noticed. And so that's a way for me to guarantee that it gets watched by people.
Well, how do you pay your bills?
I'm still figuring that out.
Aren't we all? With that in mind, you are working on another film. It is called Kindred Creatures, and you're launching a Kickstarter campaign for this. So set us up. What is Kindred Creatures?
Sure. Well, Kindred Creatures is my first feature-length film, and it's a film that kind of focuses on the similarities between the animals we call pets and the animals we call food. I think that there is a fine line that gets drawn between those two, and this film is just kind of, you know, going after that line and showing people that there are more to these animals, to chickens, to pigs, to cows than typically meets the eye.
So how do you tell the story?
Well, it's been quite a while in the making already, almost a year, and it's basically me coming up with this idea and me understanding what it is that I believe in that I want to put into a film, and then just trying to reach out to others who can help me tell that story. And so with something like this, it's stories that take place on farm animal sanctuaries, and these are places that don't really exist around the North Dakota area. And so I've been having to do a lot of traveling, a lot of reaching out to people, a lot of kind of pre-work to get the stories going so far.
Well, we have an excerpt from the film Kindred Creatures. It's kind of in segments, and this one is on a segment called Wally the Pig.
Wally was on a truck. He was 3 miles away from the Morel processing plant in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. There was a car behind the slaughter truck, and she watched Wally pushing up the back gate. After about the fifth attempt, Wally's snout popped out, and then Wally popped out of the back of that truck, and they were going 70 miles per hour on the highway, and he looked over the edge, and he jumped. She slammed on her brakes so she wouldn't hit him, thinking there was no way that he was going to survive that fall, and he rolled a couple times and got up and shook his head off, and he walked into the median and waited for the Humane Society to come rescue him. He knew he was going to slaughter. He saved himself. Absolutely, he saved himself. He came out of that with some road rash and limped on his hoof for a while. Perfectly fine.
We packed up the trailer and went down to Sioux Falls, and I walked into the barn with him and laid down, and he looked at me, and I fell so hard in love with this pig.
Well, that's the Wally the Pig segment from Kindred Creatures. This is a full-length documentary that our guest Samuel Sprinsenatic, a Bismarck-based filmmaker, is working on currently. Wally is a character in your film.
Yes, he's a character in my film, and he's a character in real life. He's
he's still alive.
He is. He's actually – I actually went and saw him last week. I shot the Wally video maybe 6 months ago and created the edit and went back and shot with him a little last week. And yeah, he's gotten bigger. He's doing great. That sanctuary that he lives at is just so happy and full of love and a great place for him to be living.
It sounds a little like, what's that they're saying in Charlotte's Web? He's a heck of a pig. Or
Well, does it make you look at a ham sandwich in a different way, Sam?
Well, yes, it definitely does for me. And I'm hoping that it does for other people as well. Because what I'm learning is I'm going out to these sanctuaries and talking with these people who live so intimately with these animals, and actually meeting these animals and, you know, hanging out with them, is I'm learning the intelligence that pigs have. Pigs are actually more intelligent than dogs, and people seem to kind of push the pigs under the mat, so to speak, and, you know, decide that a pig can be used for food, but a dog should be loved. And so for me, it definitely, you know, makes me think differently about these animals. What about you?
That's a good question. I mean, maybe I need to see this documentary.
I think you will, yeah.
You seem to have you want to make a message. You want to say something to your audience.
Yeah, it's me wanting to say something, but I also think it's the animals wanting to say something. I just kind of want I say it's especially in North Dakota, it's something that people don't get to – they don't really get to see these animals in environments that cause for their natural traits to come out. And so it's definitely a message that I think should get out there so that people can understand really who pigs are, who chickens are, who any of these animals are.
Why Kickstarter for raising money for kindred creatures?
Sure. Well, it's a story that I would like to focus on because I've shot a small portion of it over the past few months and made a couple edits, which will come out next month. But I'm looking to raise an amount of money that will allow me to focus on this film full time for about 10 months, being shooting it and editing it. And I've had a friend of mine who did a successful Kickstarter campaign in the area, and I've, for some reason, my gut's just telling me to go for it. And so if you need to raise quite a bit of money in a shorter period of time and you have a message that I think people can relate to, hoping that Kickstarter is the way to go, I guess we'll see.
And where would people ultimately see kindred creatures?
Sure. Well, the Kickstarter campaign is hopefully going to be going live at the beginning of October. And to keep in touch with that, people can go to my website, samuelspry.com, and sign up for my newsletter, and that will give them updates to when it's coming out and what's happening with the film. But in order to see it, that'll probably be, let's see, in 2019 that there's a public release. I think it'll take me till the end of 2018 to complete, and then I'll try to do festivals. And so depending on, you know, where I can get it seen, festivals will be a place where people can see it. Hopefully something like Netflix one day, iTunes. And if I don't get distribution from any of those places, I will just self-distribute it, maybe through Vimeo. There's quite a few different options. And I guess until I get a little further down the road, I'm not quite exactly sure the perfect option for it yet.
It's a brave new world, filmmaking these days, because it used to be you needed, you know, 35mm or 70mm film and a big crew and all that. Now you do it all yourself.
Yeah. It's definitely hard that way, but it's also rewarding that way. I have my vision of what I want to create can kind of remain consistent throughout. Or if I decide halfway through the project that something needs to be changed, I can kind of make that call myself. I do have my girlfriend, her name is Medora Fry, and she's been coming along with me actually to all of these sanctuaries, and she's been my first and kind of only help now in my film. She'll do audio for me. She'll help with some of the interviews. She's kind of coming on as a producer. So my crew has grown a little bit, but I still do most of it myself.
Sounds like it's doubled in size.
Exactly.
Medora Fry and Samuel Spry. There's a certain poetic...
I've never even thought of it like that. That's good.
You have a lot of work that is commercial work. You have done a number of mini documentaries, and now with Kindred Creatures venturing into feature-length film. What have you learned about filmmaking in feature-length in that medium that you hadn't come across yet?
Oh, geez, how hard it is and how much time it takes to create something like Uncle Albert or my newest short film being Roosevelt, which is going to probably have a public release sometime in the next 6 months. But those are 14-minute short films, and those are stories that I can, you know, kind of shoot at my leisure and edit at my leisure, and it doesn't take a lot out of me, if that makes any sense. But with a feature length, I mean, it's been like a year of prep work almost already just to start to fundraise for it. And so there are these two different entities in different ways that kind of go into getting the project started and editing the project. And in terms of making something interest people and making a storyline that flows for that period of time is definitely, you know, definitely a lot different than a shorter subject.
Being Roosevelt, that is about those President Roosevelt reenactors. It sounds whimsical.
Yeah. It was actually a really cool story. I'm teamed up with the Theodore Roosevelt Medora Foundation to do this one. And I went out to the Badlands over the course of, it was like 5 days this summer, because each year they have a gathering of Roosevelts. And it's where people from around the country that portray Roosevelt, they all kind of gather together for a few days and put on different performances, and they learn from each other, and they walk around the town of Medora and talk to people. What I'm learning with these guys as well, though, is that there's also now a new group of people coming along that are portraying Theodore Roosevelt's wife and Theodore Roosevelt's son and his daughter. And so there's just kind of this whole family aspect where people are just performing as a Roosevelt now.
It's kind of time travel.
Yeah, exactly.
So in the case of a film like that, do you feel like you need to do a lot of research? Do you know a lot about Theodore Roosevelt going into a shoot like that?
Sure. I do a little bit of research going into something like that because I do like to be knowledgeable as to what sorts of things I should be searching for within the story. But I also think that being a documentary filmmaker, it's best to go into a subject with your own interest and with wanting to learn more yourself. And then those things will kind of come back to people. And so I did do a little research, but I would say the majority of what I learned happened throughout the shoot. These men and these women would tell me quotes and they would tell me stories about these people that I had no idea. And so it kind of, yeah, my knowledge of it keeps growing now too.
When I went on your website, SamuelSpry.com, I noted that when you were talking about yourself, describing what you do, you talked about a 2015 short documentary called A Letter for Steve.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, sure. Well, that was a documentary film I created a couple of years ago for my friend who was facing some prison charges. It was a story here in Bismarck based on a skateboard store, Discontent, and long story short, the store got closed down and the manager, Steve, was facing prison charges for something that he definitely was not guilty of. And so when I saw what was happening with his story and with the way that the media was portraying him and going to his court cases, it just really made me want to do something. And I didn't realize how powerful documentary film could be until after I created this. I had worked at Discontent for a couple of years and had filmed at Discontent for years, so I had a lot of footage. And when Steve's trial came out, I went through all of this footage that I had racked up over the years and just created a documentary showing his character and who he really was and the impact he had on the youth of our community and the impact that he had on all of his employees, and just kind of showed him and the store he worked at in a different light than what the media was portraying it as. And that kind of opened up a whole new conversation about him and about his trial that led to, you know, now he's completely off. He didn't face any prison charges. And, yeah, what was meant to be kind of came to.
Samuel Sprinsonatic is a Bismarck-based filmmaker. You can check out his work and find out more at SamuelSpry.com, including finding out about that Kickstarter campaign for his full-length documentary, Kindred Creatures. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
More Main Street in a moment.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by North Dakota Living. Celebrating more than 64 years of featuring the great people and places of North Dakota and proudly serving the members of North Dakota's electric and telephone cooperatives.
And by Basin Electric Power Cooperative of Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative, generating and delivering electricity for 2.8 million consumers in 9 states, spanning from the Canadian to the Mexican border.
President Obama looks at me, and he says, "Oh, how's it going, David?" I had exactly one thought in that moment. I did not realize we were going to have to answer questions.
Join us next time for more True Stories Told Live. This week, stories about being called to serve. That's the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Tom Ezern is a historian, a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University, and a prolific writer, speaker, who finds interesting details about times past and shares them with us as plainsfolk essays. Today, his subject is Song of Memory.
Spread before me, on the dining room table, are 18 previously unstudied texts of that classic folk song, The Anthem of the Plains, Little Old Sod Shanty on the Claim. Call me a nerd, but this is a little exciting for me. I can now draw new conclusions about the history of the song. All this courtesy of the Digitized Newspaper Index, Chronicling America, administered by the Library of Congress. Little Old Sod Shanty is a parody of the minstrel song Little Old Log Cabin in the Lane, published in 1871 by the Kentuckian Will Hayes. Early versions of the Sod House parody, published out west, often include a notation something like, air, little old log cabin in the lane, for the guidance of singers. I find versions of the song appearing in prairie papers commencing in 1883. Since the versions exhibit variations in text, I believe the song was in oral circulation before that, likely from the 1870s. All versions are closely similar in form and wording, however. So the verbal DNA evidence argues against what a folklorist would call polygenesis, that is, multiple authorships. Some person or local ensemble came up with this song, and it spread from that common origin. Just where was that particular origin? And I cannot say. The song springs into newspaper circulation simultaneously in both Dakota Territory and Kansas, with outliers in Montana, Minnesota, and other prairie places. I find a note in the Interocean magazine of 1883 claiming the song originated with one F. E. Jerome, a newspaperman in Smith County, Kansas, in 1878, but I have not confirmed this. It bears investigation, but I am skeptical, as many others have claimed authorship. On the other hand, the newspaper in Waukini, Kansas, supports the attribution to Jerome. It is evident that the song, Little Old Sod Shanty, had two lives. It circulated first on the broad homesteading frontier of the Great Plains. It exhibited variations, both local and random. One Dakota version includes a reference to sloughs, and a Minnesota version refers to the Valley of the Sioux. Quite a few versions allude to the showman, P.T. Barnum, expressing the fear that if Barnum were to see how the singing homesteader was living in his sod house, he would make him into a sideshow. The most elaborate publication of the song took place in the Thomas County Cat of Colby, Kansas. This paper published a standard text in the voice of the homesteader, a reply in the voice of a sweetheart left back east, who professes to be enjoying life there and declines to move west and live in a soddy, and a reply to the reply, wherein the homesteader says, never mind, he has made a fortune in town lots and now has plenty of other options for female companionship. The second life of the song took place post-frontier in old settler picnics and Chautauquas. Individuals rendered the song as a remembrance, often with audiences joining in, indicating they were familiar with it. This memory function for the song appears to be a North Dakota phenomenon, with ritual singing at gatherings in the state, as well as at North Dakota reunions in California and Oregon. So now we know a lot more about the little old sod shanty on the claim. But thank goodness, mysteries remain to be investigated.
That's Tom Ezern. Coming up on Main Street, Matt Olin will deliver this week's film review a day early because tomorrow he and two of his film viewing cohorts, Brittany Goodman and Greg Carlson, will join us to offer their preview of the fall movie season. And Ashley Thornburg and I will share our What's Happening calendar of events after that. First, though, the news with Danielle.
An interim legislative committee is looking at the possibility of adopting a self-insurance plan for North Dakota public employees. Right now, the state has a hybrid plan, which combines elements of a fully paid plan with self-insurance. The interim health care reform review committee will be studying all of the options. Fargo Republican Representative Jim Casper is a proponent of a self-insurance plan.
I believe that a lot of legislators and probably the public really don't understand this word or terms of self-funding. They hear that word or those words and they say, gee, that's terrible, big risk. Well, when you properly design a modified self-funded health insurance plan, there's hardly any risk with properly designing it and properly funding it. And there's a whole lot of upside as far as saving costs.
Casper says the state would be able to make adjustments in the plan to make it more cost-effective. But Bismarck Republican Senator Dick Devers says he hasn't made up his mind yet on which way to go. Devers says the current insurance plan is closer to self-insurance than a fully paid plan.
Under our current program, in my understanding, the profits come back to the state. the carrier absorbs the risk. So we don't have any loss. So it doesn't make any sense to change that from what we have now. But I think the carriers may be reluctant to bid it unless they have the flexibility to build in enough to cover their risk.
The committee will make a recommendation to the 2019 legislature. Senator Heidi Heitkamp wants a federal investigation into the massive hack on Equifax. The hack may have compromised the personal information of 143 million Americans, including 248,000 North Dakotans. Heitkamp says this is wrong on a number of levels.
First thing we see is an inadequate response to the breach. And then we learn that three executives with this company thought that selling it between the time that they knew about the breach and the time the public knew about the breach, that what they ought to do is sell some of their stock. This is exactly why people don't trust major organizations who do this.
Heitkamp says there is a bipartisan call for a Senate Banking Committee probe, as well as investigations by a number of federal agencies. She says she wants to make sure this won't happen again. And North Dakota's flu season is around the corner, and select healthcare providers have vaccines available. Molly Howell is Immunization Program Manager for the North Dakota Department of Health. She says there have already been four cases of influenza confirmed within the state. She says before long, healthcare providers everywhere should have vaccines on hand, but there are some in the state who can give flu shots.
The current flu vaccine, there's two different versions. One protects against three different strains of influenza, two that are A strains and one B. And then the other vaccine protects against four strains of influenza, so 2B and 2A. And when they choose which strains to include in the flu season or in the flu vaccine, it's usually based on whatever was circulating in the southern hemisphere, and that's kind of how they make that decision. But we really won't know until the flu starts circulating how good of a match this year's vaccine will be to whatever flu is circulating.
Howell says pregnant women, children, and elderly are especially vulnerable to the flu, as well as individuals with chronic health conditions. She says the more people who get vaccinated by the end of October, the better, but it's never too early or too late to get a flu shot. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Well, there's the fanfare. It means it's time to talk about the movies with Matt Olien. And this time, Matt, we're talking about an unusual film for us because it's a North Dakota film made by friends of yours, Valley of Bones.
It's very unusual because, as we've discussed a few times, Doug, North Dakota does not invest in filmmaking. There's no tax breaks. There's no tax incentives. That's a whole other issue for another day. But Dan Glazer is the writer and director of Valley of Bones. Stephen Maloney is one of the lead actors in the film. He plays kind of a drug addict who happens onto this Tyrannosaurus Rex bone out by Amadon in the Badlands. And then that kind of that's how the film starts getting going. Stephen and Dan live in L.A. I had Dan in class years ago at Morehead State as an adjunct professor in video production. And he and Stephen both come back every summer and teach at Trollwood. And my son has been in their classes. So I'm going to do this review a little differently. I told people a long time ago, I don't really want to do a normal review for people that I know. Because if I praise it too much, I'm not objective. And if I don't like it, that can have bad feelings. So let's just talk.
You're being careful.
Let's be careful. we'll talk about what the film's about. It's still screening in theaters in the state. And I'm just so glad that Dan and Stephen came and shot this film in the Badlands. And, you know, when I had Dan in class, I could tell he had something special. His work was just a little better than the other kids' work. He really wanted to go places. He's a great teacher. And so this story is really about paleontology out in the Badlands. And as I said, Stephen Maloney's character, and Stephen's a very good actor, discovers this bone, and then he gets involved, this local paleontologist played by actress Autumn Reeser. And if you look her up, she's got a lot of credits. She's somewhat well-known. She's very good in the film as well. And they kind of join forces to try to see if they can find an actual, you know, T-Rex down there. Of course, there's side stories. Maloney is in deep with gangsters. He owes them money. He was a former drug runner. And Autumn Reeser's character is trying to reconnect with her son because her son's father has passed away and they were divorced. And so there's kind of a complicated situation there. And she brings him along in the dig. But, of course, gangsters are on the run and there's going to be some weird things going on. The cinematography is very good. Like I said, the two leads are very good. I don't want to get too much into the film. It's not going to win Oscars, obviously, but I'll give them credit for several things. The film's short. It's about 90 minutes long. And one thing I find, Doug, with small budgeted films is they sometimes think they have something better than they do. And all of a sudden, it's like a 110-minute film, and the film has no business being that long. Longer films are typically films with more special effects, big name actors, that kind of thing. So Dan keeps it very short, 90 minutes. The action keeps rolling. The script is fairly interesting. The acting is pretty solid. And, of course, people are going to enjoy the scenery of around Amadon and the Badlands and the paleontology digs and everything like that. So I give them a lot of credit for coming out to North Dakota, shooting a film with absolutely no help from the state. This is a small independent film, and it really shows what keeps the film industry strong, Doug. People that just want to make a film. They might not win Oscars. We might not know who they are. We might not see them at award shows, but they're working hard. It's a lot of hard work, and the film is screening, and I invite people to go see it.
The people I know who have seen it, and I have not, have said it, they did a lot with a little bit of money.
I think that's a great point, Doug, and that's what I want to say. They did not have a lot of money for this shoot, but it looks good. The production values are very good. Sometimes what happens with a lower-budget film is they find two good leads, and then the down-the-line actors kind of let the film down because you need those good down-the-line actors. And that doesn't let them down very much here. They found pretty good supporting actors to go with Stephen Maloney and Autumn Reeser. Dan's got a great eye. He knows his way around a scene. He knows how to edit scenes and things like that. Stephen co-wrote the script with him. And John Wanzek is involved in this film as well, a local name that people might remember as well. He's the producer on the film. So Valley of Bones, they had a big premiere a couple weeks ago. It's still at West Acres in Fargo. Please check your listings statewide. And I wish Dan and Stephen well, and I'm sure they'll be back here in the summer to teach Trollwood again.
All right. Meanwhile, you and your son took in Sean Astin at the Fargo Theater last night. It looked like it was a fun
night. It was a great night. This was kind of a roll of the dice for us at the Fargo Film Festival, Doug, to have a Fargo Film Festival and Hero, the Hero organization that Brent Brandt works with, got this going as well. To have a film festival welcomes a big name, not during film festival week, because these people are busy, and sometimes you have to fit them in other places, and it worked out very well. My son was very pumped because he's a huge Lord of the Rings fan of the books and the film. Sean was very gracious. We got our pictures taken with him. We visited with him, and my son did his Smeagol impression for him as well.
Right.
So he mentioned that in the show.
I've got one, I think, rather difficult Oscar trivia question here. Who was the first person to win three Oscars for a single film?
Wow. Three Oscars for a single film. We're probably looking for producer, writer, and director is what I'm guessing here,
that
Doug.
That is correct.
I'm going to guess Billy Wilder for The Apartment.
You are 100% correct. Billy Wilder for Best Picture of 1960.
60, yeah.
We've been to the movies with Matt O'Lean.
Do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. We want to hear from you.
Thousands of families affected by disasters urgently need your support. You can help the American Red Cross provide warm meals, shelter, and hope to families when they need it most. Please join North Dakota State University Performing Arts and the Fargo-Moorhead Symphony Orchestra for a benefit concert at NDSU's Festival Concert Hall at 2 p.m. Sunday, September 17th. Free will donations will be accepted with 100% going directly to Red Cross Disaster Relief to help those affected by 2017 hurricanes in the United States.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg and Chef Tim Rosendahl. It's time to talk about food, maybe something sweet this week.
Well, that's because we're celebrating National Papaya Month. Thanks, Rosie, for being here.
I love it. You know, and who would have thought that Christopher Columbus would give that name of the papaya the fruit of the angels?
He must have liked it.
I read that and went, wow. And the consistency of papaya, I just love, because it's as spreadable as a soft butter when it's set out at room temperature. And I love that, too. And the riper it gets, the sweeter it gets, as with most fruit. But it is an amazing fruit. We don't see much of it up here in the Midwest because of its growing season is shorter. It is available year-round because we do harvest fruit all over the world. Now, surprise, surprise. But it's just not – we don't see as much in the Midwest because it is a very tropical fruit.
So where does it grow in those tropics?
Well, it grows in the Caribbean, Central America, South Mexico. We do grow papaya in Florida and Texas, California and Arizona, but – again, Hawaii is the only state that grows it commercially. Do I have papaya trees in my backyard in Miami? Absolutely. But do we grow it commercially? No. Somebody tried to grow it in North Dakota, I would say, good luck with that. You better keep it inside all the time.
Yeah, I would think so.
Do they call it the papa in the South?
Yeah, you know, and that's, I don't know if I hear more of that in the South or more from Jamaica, the Caribbean, and Central America. And papa can be... Or a tree melon. I hear that all the time, too, because it does eat like a melon, but it's the only melon I know that's hanging up in a tree.
And is it good for us?
Well, it's loaded with vitamin C, and it has a unique chemical in it called papaine. Maybe I'm using the wrong term of chemical, but... And that papain is one of the main ingredients in many meat tenderizer. It has the ability to break down protein. So if you're marinating steaks or chicken or beef or whatever you're making, if you use papaya in the marinade, just like pineapple, papaya is just 10 times stronger, it will help to break down the protein in the meat. But word to the wise, when you pick a papaya, that papain on your skin can blister your skin. It's very, very strong. Where it's most concentrated at the peak of where the papaya is attached to the tree.
You know, I've noticed papaya enzymes sold sometimes as a digestive enzyme, and they're pretty handy on Thanksgiving when you may or may not eat too much and then pop a couple papaya, and it helps anyway.
Well, I've never used it like that. Being a chef, I kind of stick to the fresh fruit.
Well, this is the pill form,
yes,
yeah.
The pill form. India's the largest producer, and when I read the numbers, it's actually 5 times as much as Brazil, which is more than 10 times as much as the United States. So we are not very big in the tropical fruit papaya business in this country.
Well, I've noticed it, of course, in the supermarkets for years now, but it's rather recent in terms of being readily available up here.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny because the ones I see in the Midwest are these little 3-ounce, 5-ounce, 7-ounce, 3-inch, 5-inch, but I've seen them 10 pounds. I've seen them bigger than a football, big as a basketball. And the shape it's not necessarily like mangoes. It can have a lot of different shapes. It can be round, it can be elliptical, it can be, there's so many, and the colors of the fruit inside can be orange, it can be yellow, it can be green, it can be red, and all just different stages of ripeness or different varieties. The Meridol variety is the number one commercially produced papaya, but all of those different colors, I like it sweet, but I know for years when I had restaurants in the South, in Florida, all of my Caribbean, Jamaican, Haitian people, they love to cook papaya. Green, hard as a rock, which we don't know of at all in this part of the country. But when it's green, when it's unripe, you cut it, you poach it, just like you would a acorn squash or anything else. You cook it until it's soft, and then they saute it with cider vinegar, hot sauce, of course.
Ooh.
Jamaicans all the time, hot sauce, black pepper, and eat it as a vegetable. As with many tropical fruits, they're more often than not eaten as a vegetable before they ripen and become a fruit. Why? Because they're hungry. when it's not ripe, when I'm hungry, I'm going to eat it the way it is on a tree. I got one, and I'm hungry, and I'm going to eat it.
Well, Hurricane Irma tore up Florida. We've seen that the orange crop there has been wiped out, and papaya grows in Florida, too.
Yeah, we don't produce much commercially, but yes, I'm more afraid, as we talked earlier, Doug, about the oranges, because it's not only just the oranges for the season or, you know, worried about orange prices going up for a week or a month, but we're talking about the trees. The trees, when they're wiped out, well, I don't know if the word wiped out is the right term, but if we lose a high percentage of those, that means the prices are going up for a long, long time.
Can you do anything with the seeds from papaya?
I'm amazed how many people throw those away, and we've always saved them, again, because I was trained by Caribbean chefs, Floribian chefs, we called them. But those seeds, put them in the oven at 200 degrees, do nothing to them, dry them out, make sure they're completely dry, put them in one of your pepper grinders, and put them right next to your spices. They don't have to be refrigerated if you've dried them out completely, and then use them just like you would Madagascar green peppercorns or pink peppercorns or Malabar black peppercorns. Now you have a papaya. We'll call it a papaya corn. It's a papaya seed, but use that flavor, and it is a little bit astringent and it is a little bit peppery, but use that on a fruit salad. Use that on a prosciutto and melon appetizer. Use that. I like to use it on fruit. I'm not saying that you can't use it on chicken dish or beef or anything else. I just happen to start using it on fruit dishes.
Well, when we have a ripe papaya, we can just slice it and scoop it with a spoon. But what other ways would you like to serve it as a chef, being inventive?
Well, when it's buttery and soft consistency, you can't help but make a wonderful sorbet or ice cream or granite or sauce for ice cream or jam or jelly or preserves. It's a wonderful tasting fruit. I think it has a very unique flavor. I can't compare it to any other fruit that I've eaten in my life. It's a very distinctive flavor. It's a little, like I said, the texture of butter. It has a little bit of a musky. In fact, the cantaloupe, the musk melon, has that musky flavor as well. But it is a very unique flavor, and it's something that it's good in salads. We used to do a papaya sauce for a crisp duck breast. We used to do a papaya sauce for a halibut with a butter papaya sauce was wonderful. So, again, it can be used sweet. It can be used savory. Has lots of different applications.
What do you want to look for in the store to make sure that you're getting a good papaya?
Well, if you've learned anything after this radio show, you know that you can buy it green because you can cook it and eat it unripe. But in the store, you're looking for the same texture as what you know for what you like in an avocado. And you're looking for that soft to the touch. At the bottom of your thumb, you're looking for that sensitive, that a little bit mushy. And, you know, and once it gets ripe, just like an avocado, it's not ripe.
Too late.
Done, overripe, gone, garbage. You know, it happens so quickly that it's surprising.
Well, if you like papaya, this is a great treat this time of year or any time of year.
Yeah, any time of the year if you've got good grocery stores in your neighborhood.
If you have a question for Chef Rosie,
send it to mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or find us on Facebook. We are Main Street at Prairie Public.
What's happening is next.
I'm Christopher Kimball from Milk Street. This week, we investigate the little-known cuisines of Turkey with Robin Eckhart. She's author of Istanbul and Beyond. Also on today's show, Dan Pashman of The Sporkful makes Rosa Parks' peanut butter pancake recipe. I check in with a food critic who is trying to eat one taco a day for an entire year, and we offer a recipe for pesto trapanese. Coming up this week on Milk Street Radio from PRX.
Sunday at 1 Central, noon Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Every Thursday, Ashley Thornburg and I ask that question, and as it turns out, on a beautiful September month, there's a fair amount going on.
Like getting chased by zombies. Wait, would you have to run really fast if you're just getting chased by zombies? Oh, this is actually You Are the Zombie during the Zombie Run 5K Saturday the 16th in Minot at Oak Park. And this is a fundraiser for the YWCA. And zombies will be chasing the runners throughout the park and trying to steal runners' flags, like flag football style. And if you make it through the whole run with at least one flag left, you will survive. Registration begins at 4:30 p.m. The race starts at 6 p.m. It is $30 for runners, 35 day of. And makeup will be supplied for the zombies.
Very good.
Again,
well,
that's Saturday the 16th in Minot at Oak Park.
Well, if you're wearing those kinky boots, you might want to take them off if you're going to be in the zombie run. But that's the show, Monday and Tuesday at Grand Forks at the Chester Fritz Auditorium. It's based on true events. pants, kinky boots, tells the heartwarming and humorous story of two people with nothing in common, or so they think. Charlie's a factory owner struggling to save his family business. Lola's a fabulous entertainer with a wildly exciting idea, and they will entertain you. It's 7:30 Monday and Tuesday in Grand Forks at the Chester Fritz. Tickets run from $22 to $62.
It is Agriculture Education Day coming up Wednesday the 20th in Strasburg at the Welk Homestead State Historic Site. You can learn about the past and present technology and uses for agriculture, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Wednesday the 20th in Strasburg at the Welk Homestead State Historic Site. And it is free.
Well, here's another bit of history called ZZ Top. They've been playing for each other for almost 50 years. They're going to be in Fargo on Friday at Shields Arena in South Fargo. Venerable would describe these Texans who've been together for a long time. They'll be opened by Tim Montana and the Shrednicks, another great name for a group. The music starts at 7:30 p.m. Again, that's at Shields Arena in South Fargo. The tickets from $32.50 to $82.50.
German Culture Fest this Saturday the 16th in Moorhead at the Yumkamp Center. This is a fun-filled day for the whole family. Again, it's Saturday the 16th. You get to learn about German heritage and history of this community, as well as get to enjoy some performers. You get to take in some art, food, beer, of course. And this is from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. on Saturday the 16th in Moorhead at the Yumkamp Center. It is just $5 to get into German Culture Fest.
Prairie Post Office is a book talk and signing. It's on Sunday in Bismarck at the North Dakota Heritage Center and State Museum. Stephen R. Bolduc, Amy Phillips, Wayne Goodmanson, and Kevin Carvell will present this program based on their contributions to a book recently published by NDSU Press. The Prairie Post Office uses the insights and experiences of rural North Dakotans to highlight the critical roles of rural post offices and postal employees, and it features lots of photos. It's at 2 o'clock on Sunday again at the North Dakota Heritage Center and State Museum, and it's free.
UND Hockey Fan Fest 2017 coming up this Saturday the 16th in Grand Forks at the Ralph Engelstad Arena. This is a free event to come and meet the men's hockey team. Even you get the opportunity to get an autograph, enjoy a free lunch, and get some cool promotional items for the UND Fighting Hawks. This starts at 1 p.m., goes until 2:30. Saturday the 16th in Grand Forks at the Ralph Engelstad Arena, UND Hockey Fan Fest 2017.
The Fargo-Moorhead LGBT Film Festival is Friday and Saturday in Fargo at the Fargo Theater. This year's ninth annual LGBT Film Festival features local and international productions with short features, full-length features, documentaries, and animated pieces. The shows start at 8 o'clock on Friday and 2 and 8 on Saturday. It's $10 per screening or $30 for the festival.
All right, here is one that is a week from today, Thursday the 21st in Minot at the Gordon Olson Library. There is going to be a visiting artist, Aaron Reiners from Grand Rapids, Minnesota, is going to be attending the closing reception for an exhibit of acrylic paintings. Again, this is Thursday the 21st in Minot at the Gordon Olson Library Gallery, 6:30 to 8 p.m., and it's free.
Well, here's my pick for this week. It's Corks and Canvas. It's the last one for the season. I know lots of communities around North Dakota do this now, where they have these walks downtown, and maybe you'll have a little wine stop if you got the right wristband. But it's an idea to show off what's downtown. And it's this evening in Fargo, downtown Broadway. And again, it's the end of the season for the Art and Wine Strolls. It runs from 5 to 9 this evening. It's free for all ages, but the Corks part is for those 21 and older wearing the Walk's $20 wristband. What's your pick?
All right, my pick is this Sunday the 17th, there is going to be a benefit concert in support of hurricane relief. Proceeds going to the Red Cross helping 2017 hurricane victims. Of course, you've heard the news about Harvey and Irma. And this concert is Sunday the 17th in Fargo at NDSU's Festival Concert Hall. It gets going at 2 p.m. Free will donations, proceeds benefiting the American Red Cross, supporting those affected by Hurricanes Harvey and Irma.
And Merrill Pepcorn of the Radio All-Stars will be among those performing. So take it in. That's what's happening.
Oh, too much happening. I'm flying through the world. Too much happening. This is Dakota Datebook for September 14th. The Federal Highway Act of 1921 established the Bureau of Public Roads, in charge of mapping plans for a national highway system. But those improvements would take time, and traveling any distance by automobile remained a challenge. There were few paved roads. Even roads listed as good were likely unpaved, making mud a constant hazard. On this date in 1922, the Ward County Independent reported that a group of adventurous North Dakotans had just returned from a challenging 10,000-mile journey by car. Mr. and Mrs. Carl Bach and their sons, Clayton and Kenneth, had joined Dr. and Mrs. R.C. Lang on June 17th, setting off in a Ford sedan and a Buick. They planned to visit family and friends on their travels and were determined to see the American West, and see it they did. The group drove through the Black Hills and declared it to be some of the most beautiful scenery in the world. They paused there to fish in the clear streams. Then they headed west to Colorado. They spent the 4th of July in Mesa Verde National Park and hiked for miles. They visited Glacier National Park and dared some of the worst roads of the trip to reach Crater Lake. They stopped at Yosemite Park on their way to San Francisco. There, they were thrilled to swim in the ocean, but said no one should go to California unless they had considerable money, as everything was very expensive. The travelers took the southern route on their return. Mr. Bach said there was no amount of money that could coax him back into the desert. That leg of the trip took them 5 days, and the temperature hit 106 degrees, but he was glad for the experience. The car suffered 3 flat tires and a few broken springs, but there were comparatively few difficulties. Mr. Bach said the travelers had seen many wonderful sights, but he added that North Dakota sure looked good, saying, "The finest thing I have seen in a long while was Main Street of Minot, brilliantly lighted as I drove in from the south the night of our return." Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Bill Evanina is the guy whose job it is to keep America's secrets safe, to catch spies, to root out moles, and to make sure big leaks, think Edward Snowden, never happen again. Are you confident it won't happen again?
No, and I'm pretty sure that it will.
Our conversation with the head of U.S. counterintelligence on the next Morning Edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Friday on Main Street, we're going to the movies, our fall movie preview show. Our own Matt O'Lean and fellow film buffs Brittany Goodman and Greg Carlson will give us the lowdown on all the hits and misses coming to the big screen. And every Friday, of course, News Director Dave Thompson joins us for our weekly news chat. We hope you'll join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.